anybody out there?
Roll up! Roll up! Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, books, comics, sci-fi, TV, and film, live from the Palace of Glittering Delights!
And here, your host, Dandrew Leyland.
On a recent episode of Superman 2 Movie Minute, co-host Chris Franklin mentioned a comic book story that originally saw print in Superman issues 296 through 299. Who took the super out of Superman? This story, a long-time favourite of mine, is a great Bronze Age tale featuring the Man of Steel, but one that seems to get little love. It's epic for its time, running over four issues, and boasts a great premise. There's an interesting plot from Elliot S. Magin and Curry Bates, and sturdy storytelling from artists Kurt Swan and Bob Oskner. I've only ever seen this story referenced one other time. Mark Waid mentioned that it was shortlisted for the Superman in the 70s trade paperback, where it was eliminated from inclusion on grounds of length. This, I feel, is a crime for what I remembered to be a great story. However, the caveat must be mentioned that I hadn't read this in years. Would it hold up? Superman 296 was published with a cover date of February 1976, around the time Superman the movie will have been going into full-on pre-production. The cover by Bob Oskner as Clark Kent striding away from Superman, with Superman saying, "That's it, Clark. Our double life is over. Goodbye and good luck. You're going to need it." It's a striking image with its stark white background and intrigues even readers that are aware that covers of this era frequently lied to us. The story within the issue is wonderfully high concept. We swiftly learn that in tandem with baby Kal-El's arrival on Earth, there was another crashed starship. Throughout the years, the man in that starship simply observed Super Baby, then Super Boy, and then Superman, all the while reporting to his mysterious alien benefactors. His name is given as Zavir, but little else is initially revealed. I can only assume he's not a professor, but we also don't know if he is friend or foe, nor do we learn his intentions. Yet. Some prospectors who see Zavir's ship are killed, though, so it's not looking like he's on the side of the angels. The majority of the first half of the issue is some standard super feats, all of which are handled with aplomb and with tongue planted firmly in cheek by the writers. The splash page is another cover, a staple of the comics of the 60s but fading out by the time this comic saw print. There are flashbacks to the 60s when Superman was merely a boy that sets up how long Zavir has been watching Superboy. Superboy also meets what looks like President Kennedy as the president toward Smallville. The aliens that have sent Zavir are not infallible. They have failed to take into account the aging process, and are concerned that this may reveal Zavir's true nature, should he form any kind of lasting attachment. Zavir assures them that he has had no such intentions, and this is never referred to again. In the present day, Superman has to lure a swarm of killer bees away from Metropolis. It plays into Superman's nature that he isn't out to kill the bees, rather just move them away from large populations. As he whisks the insects away, he spots a boat filled with crooks that have just robbed an ocean liner. I did think Superman would aim the bees at them for a comedic moment, but Superman merely points the bees in the general direction of the sea and then stops the thieves himself. Bronze Age Superman has a reputation for not being quite as aggressive as his Golden Age counterpart, but he takes no shit from these guys. He keeps one of the bees in his cape and allows it to sting one of the thieves. He then backhands the crook into the sea. He rounds up the rest of them, ties them in seaweed, and then dumps them in the swimming pool of the ocean liner, telling the captain to chuck them overboard as shark bait. Superman really has no time for your shit. It's never explained where the bees came from, why they were targeting Metropolis, or indeed what the hell they have to do with anything. After this frivolous but fun opening, Clark meets up with Lois and Steve Lombard for karate class. Steve Lombard is the Flash Thompson of this strip, being a bit of a dick to Clark at every available opportunity. Clark can't be seen at the karate class in his Superman costume, so he takes it off, compresses it into a small ball, and then pops it in his mouth. Why couldn't he just put it in his sports bag? Ah, lovely listener. That's explained later. Clark arrives, but Steve is dicking about with a football and nearly gets hit by a passing cab. Clark uses his super speed to push Steve out of the way and takes the brunt of the car crash himself. A normal day for Superman, right? After all, he can't be hurt by this, right? Wrong! As Lex Luthor once said. Xavier was watching the whole thing, and Clark is shocked to wake up in hospital with a needle in his arm. Confused, Clark plays along until he's alone and removes the Superman costume from his mouth and puts it on. See? If it had been in his bag, he wouldn't have been able to get at it. The doctors never took his glasses off, nor checked his mouth for obstructions, which is fundamental doctor stuff, isn't it? I mean, I've watched enough ER to know that they check the mouth to make sure there's nothing in there, but these are apparently crappy doctors. Where's George Clooney when you need him? Nevertheless, Clark leaves the hospital, only to come across Skycrux on their jet platforms robbing a bank. Why do these people do this in Metropolis? Why don't they go to Texas, where there are no superheroes? Obviously, Superman can't do anything, as he has no powers. But in his frustration, he grabs a street lamp and crushes it. Realising he's back in business, he steals the Sky Cycles from the Sky Guys and lets them fall to their death. Well, okay, he catches them just before they go splat. But Superman seems really a bit off today, so it wouldn't have surprised me at all to see him let them fall to their doom. Superman is no dummy, and he tests his theory that he is without powers when without his costume. This proves to indeed be the case, but even worse, he can't use his powers if his costume is under his clothes. A robot attack on Clark by Intergang, who Clark is currently writing an expose of, leaves him bloody until he can take off Clark's socks. Despite the seriousness with which this is played, there was a wry smile raised by myself as Superman, his suit pants around his ankles, gets swatted around Clark's apartment. This is all a massive annoyance to Superman, and once he has divested himself of Clark's outer garments, he kicks the crap out of the robot. Clark is now distracted. Will he finally have to choose between being Clark all of the time, or should he be Superman? Meanwhile, Xavier learns his true mission, to use Superman to eliminate the Earth. The attack by the robot is never referred to again, and indeed seems like par for the course for a day in Metropolis. Overall, though, this was a great first issue. It's a typical DC comic of the time, which means there are no subplots and very little character humour. DC took itself very seriously, and this story makes that clear. A situation like this would no doubt have a few laughs at the expense of the hero in a Marvel book of the time, but Superman's very serious throughout. In fact, he takes everything very seriously. He's a dour sourpuss throughout this entire issue. Maybe he got out of bed on the wrong side. There's undoubtedly some silliness. Clark compressing his suit into a ball and putting it into his mouth is daft. And the robot attacking Clark in his apartment and no one being aware of it is equally silly. Clark tells his neighbours he was rearranging his furniture, which is as lame an excuse as I've ever heard. Still, overall, though, this is a great setup for a story. There's lots of mystery being built up, and Clark's dilemma is intriguing and makes the reader want to know what happens next. So what does happen next? Well, Superman issue 297, obviously. The cover shows Superman watching as Clark is beaten up by thugs. Clark Kent Forever, Superman Never is the title, which takes on an ironic tinge nowadays. The splash page is a shocking image. A hunched over and despondent looking Clark ignores burst water mains, lightning struck aeroplanes and bank robbers, claiming he doesn't wear the big red S anymore. This feels very much like the writers, Bates and Maggin, taking a Marvel idea, the hero giving it all up, and applying it to the then DC framework of high concept plots with minimal characterisation. This is a better approach than later writers, who basically nicked Marvel's framework, lock, stock, and two smoking barrels, character-based plotting and multiple subplots, and then grafted them onto DC Comics, with varying degrees of success. As with most Superman stories of the era, we open with the Metropolis Marvel saving the city from an attack. In this case, Intergang has altered the telescope at the Olympus Observatory into a weapon that emits an orange ray beam designed to nuke Metropolis. Superman stops it, of course, but he was meant to. Intergang wanted Superman to stop it. How he does it is really cool and shows Superman being tested by otherworldly and natural elements that test his powers. you know, for all the Superman is far too powerful people. The story also attempts to legitimise Clark as a character. For years, Clark was the disguise. And who, disguised as Clark Kent, ran the TV series opening. And here Clark decides to live as Clark for at least 7 days, without there being a job for Superman. In most cases, this would be hotter, but in this story, he literally isn't Superman if he isn't wearing the suit. Shades of the greatest American hero. Clark goes about his life and suddenly starts noticing things like how hot his neighbour, Murray Marigold, is, implying that as Superman, he has no time for love, Dr. Jones, but Clark will now have a lot of spare time on his hands. Next door, Clark's neighbour, Xavier, is ordered by his mysterious overlords to search Clark's apartment. Another way this story is humanising Clark is introducing his home life away from the planet. We've already had him attend a tenants' meeting, and here we have him noticing his pretty neighbour. All these characters can be used as a new supporting cast for the strip, and a way to give it some new blood. There's even mention of Clark's mysterious neighbour, who no one has ever seen. In fact, all that's known of him is his name, Mr. Xavier. The next day, Clark is having dinner with Steve and Lois, and Steve, in another dickish move, makes Clark spill his drink all over himself. Clark, no longer worried about his secret, lamps Steve, and then throws his lunch all over him. Lois starts to see Clark in a whole new light. So much so, she rocks up at his apartment later that night, makes him beef bourguignon for the first time, and is heavily implied she and Clark spent the night together. This was even more blatant in the original edit of this issue. The next day, Steve asks Lois if she's wearing the same dress as yesterday. Scandalous. She isn't, though. It's a different colour from earlier in the day, and completely different from the one that Clark's bedroom floor was wearing last night. I do wonder if Clark took his glasses off at any point. This panel, where Jimmy asks, was Lois wearing the same clothes as yesterday, was edited by Julia Schwartz, and the dialogue changed. Odd subplots happen throughout this issue, like Kandor watching Clark not be Superman for some reason, and Clark poo-poos Morgan Edge wanting to send Clark to Chile to cover a story. This makes no sense. Clark is an evening news anchor, not a field reporter. Still, it allows Clark a chance to not only stand up to Edge, but knock Steve Lombard out again in the elevator. Clark suggests Morgan send Steve. Steve isn't impressed. Lois is impressed by Clark knocking Steve out. Kandor watching Clark not be Superman is never mentioned again. Clark then follows up on his intergang story. Superman, being exposed to the orange light, actually orange star energy, would, had he used his powers, cause Superman's body to ignite and destroy half of Metropolis. So it sure is fortunate that this is the time Xavier started his experiment. Speaking of Xavier, he has found some jewels in Clark's apartment that can help him destroy the entire planet. I don't think this is ever really referred to much ever again either. Superman is covered for, in various activities, by actor Gregory Reed, at the time the man playing Superman in the DC TV universe of the comics. See, in the comics, there is a TV series called Superman. Gregory Reed, named after George Reeves, plays the character in the comic. Confused? You thought Grant Morrison was the only one who did meta storytelling? Reed was a fun character, and he's ripe for reinvention. The issue closes with Lois spending yet another night with Clark. She really must have liked that dessert. This was an interesting issue. It really exposes the idea that Superman doesn't really have to act like a klutz as Clark. Him being competent, confident and capable actually works better for him as a character. And that he's doing all this without his powers gives credence to this idea. No one thinks he's Superman because he acts like a doofus. No one thinks he's Superman at all. Superman 298, a nerve-tingling novel, according to the cover, had an inadvertently hilarious cover. Superman and Lois are having a gay old time. Lois even calls him Clark and says, "Clark Kent, I'm glad you finally realised that the world can get on without Superman, as trains fall off tracks, planes fall out of the sky, and men are shot dead behind them." It also implies Lois now knows Clark is, or at least was, Superman. "Clark Kent, get out of my life" has another of those splash pages that act like the opening credits to a Gerry Anderson show, with clips of what is to come. Lois stares at Clark's picture and ponders her love for him now that he's disappeared. Clark dropping out of sight means a judge chucks a court case against Intergang out of his courtroom, and Morgan Edge whines that without Clark, ratings are down. None of this makes a lick of sense. If this is the time for Superman to see he can live without Clark, as Clark did without Superman, why didn't Clark just book a week off work and say he was going to Tahiti? It's a magical place. The opening is a hysterical dream sequence, where Clark and Lois wander through town, ignoring all kinds of mishaps. It's darkly funny. Clark's reaction to a kid being killed by a falling plane is one of those things you laugh at and then feel a little bit bad about. But then we cut to something even funnier. Clark, in his PJs, with his Superman costume underneath. Apparently he did this in his sleep. So it's really fortunate that this wasn't a night that Lois stayed. Clark decides to live the next week as Superman only and ignore all of Clark's concerns. This leads to some super dickery on the Man of Steel's part. Now, I'm not really a fan of finding unintentional super dickery in old comments and then taking the piss, but this is a bit off of Superman. He ignores Lois knocking on his door after he promised to take her out. He then proceeds to abandon all of Clark's commitments with nary a thought. At the very least, he should have spent the day wrapping up Clark's commitments and then taking off as Superman. This isn't an emergency job that's come up. This is deliberate negligence. After he leaves, Xavier continues to snoop around Clark's apartment while Superman visits the Fortress of Solitude, where he will live this week away from earthly trivialities. Those trivialities concern his fortress's TV reception, which means not only can he not watch this week's Charlie's Angels, but he also can't monitor the world for any nefarious goings-on. Superman realises the interference in his TV signal is due to sunspot activity and speeds off to the sun to sort it out. Unbeknownst to Superman, another man has built a suit that has tons of solar energy transformers on it that will apparently give him the same power level of Superman. It's not working until Superman clears out the sunspot, and then we are left to ponder if this new character will be important or if he will be friend or foe. I'll give you a clue. He's not important. Superman, meanwhile, is off doing super stuff, which apparently ignores being a star witness in the Intergang trial. Way to uphold the law, though, Superman. Superman will show up as Clark, but only if he's sure they don't have enough evidence to testify, which is, again, stupid. Superman knows it's Clark's testimony that holds the key to conviction, and without him, this entire court case is a waste of time. Instead, Superman rounds up petty intergang criminals instead of putting them away for good in the courtroom. He also runs afoul of the man we saw earlier, now calling himself Solar Man. Sunspot would have been a much better name. Anyway, he nicks some money from bank robbers and disappears before the Man of Steel's eyes. Superman happens by the Galaxy Building, where Lois tells Morgan she's afraid Clark may have been kidnapped or killed by Intergang to prevent him testifying. Superman tells them both that Clark is fine, and he moons over how beautiful Lois is. The one thing Superman and Clark seem to have in common is they both have an eye for a pretty lady. Oddly, an Intergang employee is trying to off Clark as they speak, but he's disintegrated by Xavier, who is still in Clark's apartment. It's night time now, so he's been there all day. Apparently he's been busy, though, as he has nearly completed whatever the hell it is he's working on that will destroy Earth. We still don't know why he wants to destroy Earth. Superman, however, is struggling. It's hard being super all day, every day, with no outlet to let off steam. He tries to talk to Jimmy, but Jimmy tells him Solar Man has been wreaking havoc all day. "Stop dicking around, Superman," says Jimmy, paraphrasing. "Get out there and stop him." Superman lets slide a single man tear. He locates Solar Man, and this doofus manages to get the better of the Man of Tomorrow, giving him a right kicking. Luckily for Superman, Solar Man's suit overloads and nearly burns him alive. But Superman rips the costume from his back, and we learn that Superman did this deliberately. He was deliberately overloading Solar Man's suit with his heat vision. He was deliberately willing to set this man on fire. That's okay then. It was all deliberate. Superman knew what he was doing. Superman then makes a final decision about his future. In his apartment, Xavier has completed his work, and when he next receives a signal, Earth will be the triggering mechanism for its own assassination, which doesn't actually turn out to be true. Superman is the triggering mechanism for the destruction of Earth. But, you know, this whole plot with the destruction of Earth thing just seems like an afterthought in many ways. This third part is the most unsubstantial and underwhelming. Seeing Clark assert himself and become more of a fleshed out character is far more interesting than seeing Superman mope around and get sad because Jimmy Olsen doesn't have the time to hang out with him. The villains were also lackluster this time. Some intergang criminals and a wannabe like Solar Man are not really a challenge to Krypton's last son. The supporting cast are also ignored this issue, and that is one element of the Marvel books DC really did need to focus on and explore. Clark is interesting because of who he hangs out with. Superman doesn't really have anyone. Issue 299, the Double or Nothing Life of Superman, has his empty costume on the cover surrounded by 9 of his most arch adversaries. "Which one of them did this to Superman?" asks the cover. After messing around for nearly 3 decades, Xavier, whatever you want to call him, finally unleashes his plan. The space jewels he stole from Clark's apartment will allow him to teleport 9 of the biggest reasons Superman ever has to be anywhere. 9, count them, 9 supervillains, each with the same powers as Superman. South, Miss Teschmacher, south! Well, okay, the same powers may be a bit of an exaggeration, but the 9 are Terraman, Toyman, Mr. Mixius Pitlick, the Prankster, Amalak, Parasite, Luther, Brainiac, and the Kryptonite Man. What, no General Zod? Ultraman was busy? Metallo was on another call? What about Bizarro? There is not really anyone here on Superman's power level per se, except maybe Parasite and the Kryptonite Man. I guess the Man of Steel's rogue gallery really did need some new blood. I don't think I've ever even heard of Amalak before. Anyway, all these fearsome foes appear in Clark's apartment, which is pretty funny. All these super foes just lolling around in Clark's place, casually discussing genocide, murder, and other important items of the day while they have their feet upon his furniture. Superman arrives, but Xavier has already teleported them away, and Superman is guided by Xavier with a telepathic blast to the location of 3 of them, Terraman, Toyman, and the Prankster. Toyman is wearing a really ridiculous outfit, like he raided the Weather Wizard's pants drawer and nicked one of Superman's cowls. Superman has no problem with these 3, but must zip back from Egypt, which is where they were, to quickly attend to the court case as Clark Kent. Xavier is pissed about this, as Superman's constant expanding of energy is what will apparently bring about the world's destruction. This contradicts the idea that Earth will bring about its own destruction from the past 3 issues. Superman has no Clark clothes, and so he whips by WGBS, pops into the wardrobe, nicks a suit, and then does his civic duty by testifying against Intergang. After testifying, Clark attempts to duck out on the reporters, but inadvertently does so at super speed. Realising he has his powers back, he feels an irresistible tug to the Rocky Mountains, similar to the pull he felt towards Egypt. Luther, Parasite, and Mixius Pitlick are there, and it takes Superman a bit longer to take these 3 out because they are more powerful and not as stupid as the first 3. Superman's way of dealing with this is actually pretty clever. He uses Luther to take out the Parasite and then concentrates on Mixius Pitlick. The only issue with this is it really exposes how lame a lot of Superman's villains are. The Parasite is a favourite of mine, a really good villain with a great gimmick, and totally capable of taking Superman out. Here, removed from the picture in 3 panels. At 4 issues, this was a novel-length adventure, but it could have been longer, and concluded in issue 300, which would have been double-sized. That way you could have expanded upon Xavier's story and his ideas and his backstory, because by and large that seems rather throwaway and just the MacGuffin to get into this idea of exploring who is important, Clark or Superman. You could have also had him deal with these 9 villains more extravagantly over a greater page count. Nevertheless, the story does a great job of highlighting Superman's intelligence, though. He realises that the clothes he wore in court weren't his clothes, and a quick examination of his suits, all 300 of them, all identical, reveals that they were coated with sunscreen. Wait, what? Superman lost his powers when he was Clark Kent because his clothes were coated with Factor 30? What about his head? What about his hands? What about when he was naked? He'd spent the night with Lois, for God's sake. Surely she'd have noticed they'd added superpowers when they were up all night. No wonder Lois came back for seconds the next day. It really was a super shag. Xavier uses this opportunity to send Superman another telepathic flash, this time to Brainiac and Amalak. Whoever the hell that is. Xavier feels that these last two fights will expel enough of Superman's energies to turn him into a super bomb. Superman, however, is portrayed as being really smart in these stories and realises he's being manipulated. He follows the next telepathic brain blast back to its source, thanks to some vision, heat vision, whatever vision he has, and finds Xavier, who Clark recognises as his mysterious neighbour, Mr. Xavier. Xavier is in some kind of suspended animation, believing his job is over. So Superman scans the room for clues as to what's occurring. It's a surprise, therefore, that Superman still tackles his last villain, the Kryptonite Man. Does he not know what's happening? That this last brawl could be his last? Literally? Well, yes, lovely listener, of course he does, because he's Superman. And he uses a sun-screened Clark outfit to protect himself from the Kryptonite Man's deadly rays before KOing the villain. This must be the first instance of Superman wearing his Superman outfit over his Clark Kent suit. He then puts various members of this League of Supervillains in the Galactic Prison, along with Xavier, who he says will be waiting a long time for his mysterious rays to free him. After all, failure is not rewarded. Indeed, the alien world is worried that one day Superman will find them. And so the loose ends are all wrapped up. The use of the Clark Kent sunscreened suit is a really neat way of dealing with the Kryptonite Man problem. But we never do find out why all the aliens want to destroy the Earth, who contacted them to do so, and why it took them nearly 30 years to enact this plan. It seems like an awful lot of effort to go to spend 30 years bombarding Superman with a low-level beam that will eventually lead him to destroy the planet. Hiding Xavier while waiting 30 years also doesn't seem terribly cost-effective. Did he have a job? How did he pay for the apartment? Did the mysterious contractors know it would take 30 years to fulfil the deal? Were they okay with that? And we haven't even got into the silly notion that coating Clark's suit with sunscreen will negate his superpowers. But none of that really matters. This is a story that reaffirms who Superman is and why he needs to be Clark Kent. Without the other, neither is a complete man. You can argue a case that this is where DC realised that Clark was as potent a personality as Superman. It's a shame, really, that the epilogue to this story has Clark go back to being a mild-mannered weakling. Nowadays, this story would have been the catalyst for a new take on Clark. How great would it have been to have issue 300 establish a new Superman dynamic? A more go-getting and aggressive Clark, a proper adult relationship with Lois, and more of an even split between the two, fulfilling the promise of this story. Had they gone in that direction in 1976, would there even have been a need to reboot the character in 1986? Still, Who Took the Super Out of Superman is a great story. It's very different to Marvel's approach. It's far less bombastic, far less melodramatic, and more plot-driven. It's still held up, though. It's a great example of this era and well worth tracking down if you can. Sadly, as far as I know, it's never been reprinted in full and isn't even on Comixology. In fact, Comixology's collection of Bronze Age Superman issues is very mediocre. Of course, all of this took an interesting turn as I was preparing to record this show. DC Comics and current Superman writer Brian Michael Bendis have recently announced that Superman will renounce his secret identity starting in issues published from January 2020. People who have followed Bendis' career over at Marvel won't have been surprised by this. I think the first thing I said to my son after the announcement that Bendis was leaving Marvel after over a decade of service was, well, so long to Batman's secret ID. This was, of course, when it was believed that Bendis would be writing Batman. But it's funny that the point still stands. See, Bendis has made no secret of the fact that he thinks secret identities are silly. He can't accept them. He has no problem accepting kids being bitten by genetically altered spiders can suddenly climb walls, or aliens from other planets can have godlike powers under Earth's yellow sun, but the idea of a secret identity is apparently where he draws the line. That's where his suspension of disbelief ends. He said that in real life, people would be driven mad living two lives, and of course, he's quite correct. In real life. But superhero comics aren't real life. A good Spider-Man story is a good Peter Parker story. It's about the people that Peter Parker orbits, about how being Spider-Man affects that. He's also terrified that because of Spider-Man's reputation, if his secret is revealed, his loved ones will be targeted. So, of course, the first thing Bendis did in Ultimate Spider-Man was have Peter reveal his identity to Mary Jane and had Peter be incredibly lazy with his secret. When he wrote Daredevil, his big story was Matt Murdock being outed as the horn-headed hero. When Spider-Man revealed his real name to the world in Civil War, we were promised, as Bendis has here, thousands of new stories. But it's ultimately a dead end. Once you've got the shock out of the way and dealt with the ramifications, where do you go? You can't do slice-of-life stories anymore because their life is being a hero. There's no identifier for the audience. For me, Superman without Clark just isn't as interesting. Some heroes, like Luke Cage, can work without a secret ID, but that's because Luke's life is his life, and his work is being a hero for hire. Once Daredevil was out, the writers struggled with him. Mark Waid and Ed Brubaker made it work by taking a different tack with the stories, and Waid even had Murdock start denying he was Daredevil in an effort to roll it back. Recently, Charles Soule has only referred to it in passing. I guess my point is that stories like Who Took the Super Out of Superman detail why Clark is necessary. Is it a tad laughable that people don't recognise him? Sure, but that's part of the fun. The post-crisis era of Superman did such a good job making Clark a real person. Having him marry Lois strengthened the stories. But he still needs Clark. We need Clark. Without him, Superman is everything his detractors say he is. Rather dull. And Astro City dealt with this admirably. You can't be on duty 24/7, 365. Who Took the Super did it as well. It makes Superman an image character from the early 90s by removing the secret ID. They didn't have lives away from being heroes. You know why? Because they're harder to write. More challenging. You have to make us care. You have to have lived some kind of life to make it work. It's much easier to write stories about heroes going off and fighting and explosions and all that stuff. Much harder to write them as real people. Will Bendis make us care about a Clark-less Superman? Sure, short term probably. And short term this will generate stories. But what about long term? Or has DC given up thinking about the long term? Who took the super out of Superman? Ironically, it was DC Comics.
The Fire and Water Podcast Network is a collection of super friends plus Shag. So what could be more appropriate than a podcast about the super friends? It's For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast, a read-through show about the classic DC comic book series covering all 47 issues of the original run, plus a few surprises. Hosted by me, Rob Kelly, and a rotating group of my super friends. Coming soon from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
It all looks good to me.
Okay, let's check in on the email section. Eagle-eyed listeners. What's the equivalent for listening? Bat-eared listeners? I don't know. Eagle-eared listeners will have realised that this was not the advertised episode, my Marvel vs. DC ranking. That episode was recorded but not edited when the news dropped of Bendis outing Superman. And I'd already written this episode but not recorded it yet. So what I decided to do was swap them over in the release schedule just so this one's a bit more timely. The Marvel vs. DC ranking will be next time, unless something else happens. That one's not a timely show, so it can be released anyway. Anyway, on to the email section. Horror of Fangrock and Other Stuff is from Jason Trenner. Hello, Jason. Greetings. Well, that was an interesting Doctor Who story. A bit odd the Rutans have never really shown up again on screen in Doctor Who, given they are shapeshifters. The behind the scenes for this story shows how crazy TV making can be. For some odd and old, I have to go back to the Len Wein 20th anniversary issue of DC's Star Trek. It is amusing as Len Wein had written some gold key Star Trek issues, and those are pretty much the best issues it ever had. And pretty sure that the animated series episode Time Trap was someone ripping off those gold key Star Trek issues Len Wein wrote. It could very well be, Jason. I've never read them. I do apologise. People do keep telling me that there is something worthy about the Gōlki issues, particularly like the later ones, so maybe one day. But, you know, my list of things to read seems to get larger every day as the days march on. But thank you for emailing in. Spidey in the Swinging 60s is from Luke Giaconetti. Hello, Luke. Andy, I've been getting caught up on your coverage of the early, moving to middle years of Spider-Man on the Palace and wanted to write in. This era of Spider-Man is mostly unknown to me outside of the occasional adaptation here and there, such as parts of the Stone Tablet story being adapted for the 1990s cartoon. So having you able to shed light on this period is very enlightening and enjoyable. In a similar vein as to what you and Stephen do over on the Fantasticast for the FF in the post-Lee Kirby era. I was particularly struck by the depiction of the student protesters in this run of stories. Immediately my mind jumped to Iron Man 45 and 46 from a couple of years down the road, 1972, where protesters demonstrate outside of Stark Industries against the company's munitions business. That story is somewhat infamous, as it depicts Guardsman, Kevin O'Brien, his mind not straight thanks to an interaction with his armour, actually firing into the crowd with four protesters seemingly killed. Other protesters even scream that their comrades are dead. This is walked back in the second issue to merely injured and hospitalised, but this is still indicative of how much difference a few years can make. The overarching story is typical for Marvel at the time. The board of Stark Industries, led by the slimy Simon Gilbert, wants the protesters removed with extreme prejudice, whilst the protesters wants to burn the entire campus to the ground. Tony is the voice of reason, and is stuck in the middle, naturally. Marvel would often mine this theme in the progressive stories of the late 60s and 70s, with extremists on both sides being the real threat, and our hero the proverbial cooler head in the middle. In this way, Marvel was able to push the envelope that social issues without really taking a side and potentially driving away readers. Novel concept, that. It's interesting that that cover that Luke's talking about there, the Iron Man, is very similar to the Spider-Man one, the protesters and Spider-Man. And indeed, Peter Parker essentially takes the same position that Tony Stark seems to take in that issue. Obviously, Peter is the more rational middle side, willing to be a conversationalist, willing to be a diplomat, willing to talk to get both sides to meet in the middle. Interestingly, there is a story coming up soon that I'm longing to cover, where we see a real ultra-right-wing extremist, Sam Bullitt, who takes Gwen Stacy under his wing after, under his right wing, after the death of George Stacy. And the story goes to great lengths to show that whilst George Irma Jameson, I don't know who J. Jam Jumba Jabba 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 is, that J. Jonah Jameson, whilst being a conservative Republican, is not an extremist. And I'm looking forward to covering that because that's one of those issues where I've already mentioned the redemption of Jonah. That's one of those issues that really does pin Jonah's colours to the flag in a way that, yeah, he's a Republican. Yes, he's a conservative, but he's not on Bullitt's side, especially when Bullitt reveals himself to be very racist towards Robbie Robertson. One of the best Jonah Jameson moments in comics history. And I think that'll be coming up. That's coming up quite soon if I carry on with the Spider-Man at the pace that I'm doing it. And I'm looking forward to that story and the correspondence that it generates, because especially in our these politically incendiary times, it's interesting to look at that story now. Nowadays, there isn't a middle ground represented. You're either a right-wing Nazi or you're a left-wing tofu eater. There's no coming together anymore. That's just the way it seems to me anyway. In any event, I'm definitely enjoying your coverage of these swinging swinging web-slinging stories. Your enthusiasm for them is palpable and makes for wonderful listening during my commute or workout. Eager to see what adventure awaits the amazing Spider-Man going forward. Thanks, Luke. Well, thank you very much, Luke. As ever, a thought-provoking and interesting email. Our next email is from Symbol Pending, which is a great name. Funny you should say that. Hi, long-time listener, first-time poster. It's ironic you should mention the DC Comics Star Trek 20th anniversary not being print, as about a day after your last podcast dropped, I received an issue of the Star Trek Novel Collection, issue 72, Judgment Day, that happens to collect just this issue and those before and after. You can buy separate issues if people wish to pick up the DC or Marvel runs. That's the Partworks collection that Symbol is talking about. Which I did email to clarify, and he said, yes, it's the Eagle Moss partwork. So it's interesting that that story is back in print, should you wish to go out and get a copy. It's well worth it, well worth a read, and those hardcover collections are nice. The problem with them is I don't buy them anymore just because they take up too much damn room. But they're good. I like the patchworks. Symbol continues, in issues 35 and 36 of the comics, it's pretty bonkers, as it undoes all that's been done with Kurt losing the Excelsior and Spock, his memory, so the comic can fit in between the two films, the comic ending where the voyage home begins. Anyway, I thought you'd find this interesting. Keep making all your lovely shows. Well, thank you, Symbol, and thank you for that information. Yes, that is interesting that that is out there for you to all enjoy. Okie dokie, we'll call it a day there with the email section, and I'll see you next time, hopefully, with the Marvel versus DC Comics ranking episode, which is recorded. I just haven't had a chance to edit it yet. Like I said, I've switched around in the edit. All right, thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Drop me an email at heykidscomics.virgin@virginmedia.com. I'll say that again. heykidscomics@virginmedia.com if you want to join in the conversation. And I'll see you next time. And it's all going to be great. Everything's going to be wonderful. Nothing can possibly go tits up this week on the 19th of the 10th, 2019. Absolutely nothing could go wrong today. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.